Welcome back. Scientists say our brains will connect to computers within decades to form an internet of thoughts that will provide instant access to information. Forward-leaning scientists and researchers say advancements in society's computers and biotechnology will go straight to our heads, literally. In a new paper published in the Frontiers in Neuroscience, researchers embarked on an international collaboration that predicts groundbreaking developments in the world of human-brain-cloud interfaces within the next few decades. Using a combination of nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, and other more traditional computing, researchers say humans will be able to seamlessly connect their brains to a cloud of computers to glean information from the internet in real time. And you can read the entire article in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. Back to more of my conversation with Don Jeffries, the author of Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, as we delve into the Illuminati and the Anti-Mason Party. That conversation is next on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Don Jeffries, author of Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. Don, Adam Weishaupt, the founder of the Order of the Illuminati, the secret society that started in Bavaria back in the 18th century, he's been sort of portrayed by some as this cartoon character, but others have sort of said that his intentions were good. You look at Adam Weishaupt from sort of a different perspective. Who was he? What was he all about? What were his intentions for this order of the Illuminati? And what does any of that have to do with the United States?
Well, Weishaupt is important because the Illuminati was founded almost at the exact moment as American independence in 1776. And in fact, a lot of people, again, have speculated that it was talked about at the time. There are letters from George Washington discussing the Illuminati and Thomas Jefferson both, because there was concern that because the Freemasonry was becoming so large in the United States already at that time, and many of the founding fathers were Freemasons, including George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and many others, Sam Adams, Hancock, people like that. And they were concerned that this Illuminati, this new force, was infiltrating the lodges and corrupting them and turning them on this more radical philosophy. And certainly I have lots of quotes from Adam Weishaupt in the book that don't lend themselves to Jefferson, of all people, actually was kind of sympathetic to Weishaupt and tended to present him in a more sympathetic light. But Jefferson was kind of, he was left-leaning for the day. And I think he just thought that he was Weishaupt was striking a blow against organized religion and against superstition. Jefferson was, again, a man of enlightenment, and he believed in reason and that kind of thing. So, but I think the idea that Weishaupt had was to, the Illuminati was going, and certainly talked about in his writing, and he kind of ridiculed people when he said, oh, mere mortal man, is there nothing you cannot be made to believe? Because they were trying to appear innocuous, but I think the idea was to infiltrate Freemasonry especially and other or institutions of society, and that no one would really know who was connected other than a few, maybe you're almost like a pyramid scheme where someone would bring you into this group and you wouldn't necessarily know a lot of other people that were in the group. And this has provided fodder over the centuries for lots of people believing the Illuminati are the ones that are above it all, that are running everything ever since that day, because of the way they were apparently set up and organized initially, where they would not, you would only necessarily know the person who brought you in and maybe a couple other people, but as for everyone else, you weren't really sure who was a member of the Illuminati and who wasn't. So Weishaupt created something there. How much validity there is in that, I don't know. But certainly those of us who study conspiracies believe that there are forces that seem to be above the politicians and the leaders that we know of when we look at current events that seem to be pulling the puppet strings.
Well, would Weishaupt have looked at this grand experiment in the United States as being in opposition to the world that he envisaged?
Well, I think I don't think, just looking at his writings, that he was a believer in the same kind of liberty that Thomas Jefferson, some of the other founding fathers, individual liberty. I mean, again, he used kind of flowery prose where you might be able to make that argument, but I have some of his other quotes in the book there, again, where he scoffed at people and said, you know, basically we can make you believe anything. And I think that Illuminati, there was, in fact, there was a trilogy of the Illuminatus trilogy. I think I mentioned that before talking to you, that talked a lot about this and put Weishaupt right at the heart of the founding of the American Republic. But how much of that is exaggeration, I don't know. And certainly on the surface, maybe some of Weishaupt's philosophy, same thing could be said probably for Thomas Paine, where these people that believed in reason and were kind of striking a blow against superstition and organized religion, you could make an argument that they, but I don't think that they were the same. And I think Weishaupt, that he also has a quote in there I have, where he basically said that anyone who was committed to the Illuminati, they had to be willing to become a Brutus, basically a call for, would you be willing to kill for the cause, the assassination? And I don't think someone like Jefferson certainly would have supported that.
As you mentioned, many of the founding fathers were, and many presidents, past, present, were Masons. At a particular time in American history, though, the sentiment kind of switched against the Masons, and there was an anti-Mason party. Tell me about the formation of the anti-Mason party.
Well, it came about because of Captain William Morgan, you mentioned before, who was a Canadian Mason who mysteriously disappeared in the early 1820s. His body was never discovered. It was assumed he was murdered, and he had been wanted supposedly by the Masons for repayment of some kind of small, really kind of a small loan or something. It didn't seem to be much of a crime, but for whatever reason, public outcry began against the Masons, and they just kind of held Freemasonry responsible for what had happened. And Americans such as John Quincy Adams, who really became a tremendous anti-Mason. There was an anti-Mason party. They ran presidential candidates. And as I said, John Quincy Adams was president of the United States. He became a very outspoken anti-Mason person. I quote from him extensively in the book because he was a brilliant guy, too. I mean, I didn't agree with all of his politics, but John Quincy Adams was, if you look at the way he wrote and what you know, he spoke like seven languages and so forth, and compare him to the kind of politicians we have today, and you can see how far America has fallen. But there was tremendous sentiment for a long time, and I don't think the Masons ever really did regain the foothold they had after, although certainly several other presidents were Masons, and Masonry remained relatively popular until recent times, when I think the attendance and the membership has really dropped.
Right. And you mentioned Captain James Morgan, who was a Mason, and he disappeared, and some believe his body may have washed up. Was it on the shore of Lake Erie at some point? But wasn't he also supposed to have been writing kind of a tell-all book about the Masons, and perhaps that may have been a motivation for his disappearance?
Well, that was the speculation that he was. And we run into that so many times in these strange deaths where, you know, somebody was about to expose everything and tell all. So, yeah, that was the thinking and the speculation there behind the people who were very already probably were peeved at the Masons. And so, if he was going to do that, it is, the book has never come. You know, we've been seeing it. So, but that, yeah, that would you know, certainly. Would be interesting that he was stopped, but that's a theme I think throughout American history where they stop someone working on something at that time, and it certainly created a lot of suspicion, and it changed the political climate for a while, because the anti-Masons, I don't know if they were ever the second most popular political party, but for a while they were certainly the third most popular political party in the United States.
Did Andrew Jackson run as an anti-Mason?
No, Jackson was a Mason. He was.
He was a Mason.
Yeah,
all right.
It was a powerful Mason. They actually, the anti-Mason. I think he was the first presidential candidate they fielded a candidate against, and it was exclusively, largely due to the fact that he was a Mason.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Old Hickory, because apparently he's a favorite, president of the current president, and his portrait hangs in the Oval Office. And there have been comparisons drawn between both of them, populists. You've described Jackson as perhaps the most populist president since he was the most populist president since Jefferson. I mean, obviously, his treatment of American Indians was pretty disgraceful. But what are the lessons to be learned from Andrew Jackson? I mean, primarily, I guess, because he hated banks, right?
Yeah, well, that's why it attracts him. Yeah, because a lot about Jackson's personality I find abhorrent. I mean, certainly his treatment of the American, he was, I think it pretty much can be, certainly by the standards of the day, he was a pretty ugly racist. But and he loved war way too much for my liking. I'm as anti-war as they come, and he was one of these guys that genuinely, and he was a genuine war hero. I mean, he rose to prominence, during the War of 1812. So he was a military hero, and he still fought like a military guy. But he really hated the banks, and he after Jefferson, and I write a lot in there about one of the main battles in the early years of really the first. The breakdown politically in the early years of the Republic were between the Jeffersonians and their hatred of a central bank. They did not want a central bank, and the Federalists, who were led by Hamilton's idea of wanting a central bank, which of course later would come to fruition finally and totally as the Federal Reserve system in 1913. Jackson picked up the mantle of Jefferson and became a real foe of the when they tried to renew the charter the second charter of the central bank, and he has left tons and tons of fantastic quotes. I quote a lot of them in the book about his hostility towards banks, and I think that for that reason alone he holds my interest. And as you mentioned, he was a populist, and certainly his celebration that he held, and no other president had ever done that, where he kind of let the common riffraff in off the street after his election the first time, and they created kind of an uproar. Apparently, they muddied the White House and dirtied it up and broke a bunch of expensive stuff. So he really did let the common people in, and he never did that again, I guess, because somebody told him, look, you can't do this because they caused a lot of damage. But it was. For a populist like myself, it's hard not to like someone who let common people just kind of come into what's supposed to be the people's house.
And you mentioned that he wanted to revoke the charter of this Bank of America, which was kind of, a precursor to the Federal Reserve. It was primarily owned by foreign interests, right?
Right, and he recognized at the time, they hadn't thought of the fractional lending system, but Hamilton's... So when Hamilton first thought up the idea of debt, I mean, Hamilton's one of his most disastrous policies, and he got Washington to accept it, and it became, a strong part, unfortunately, of the American government in the early years, was that he advocated for the federal government, which was intentioned to be, was supposed to be as small and not very powerful under the Constitution. He advocated for them to assume the debt of all the individual states from the Revolutionary War. He won that battle. And ever since then, America has been, debt-loving. I mean, we look at what the situation we're in today. And that all can be laid at the feet of Broadway hero Alexander Hamilton. And Jackson recognized at the time, he didn't speak specifically that much about debt, but he understood that the way the central bank was set up, and it was set up somewhat like the Federal Reserve would be set up in 1913 for good, but then when they fine-tuned the fractional lending system, which most Americans still don't understand to this day, that's when we found ourselves in the position that we're in today, because of the disastrous system where we don't have the money, the currency's not backed up by anything, it's created out of thin air largely, and it's just a disaster waiting to happen.
And his revoking of the charter of the National Bank, any connection there between that and what is described as the first attempted presidential assassination in U.S. history? Someone tried to kill him.
Yeah, well, that's it probably isn't too surprising to people to read that the second populist president, I guess, after Jefferson. But this populist president, who was also a foe of the central banks, happened to be the first one to have a political assassination against him. Jackson certainly suspected, because it was unsuccessful, fortunately. He certainly suspected his political foes, and that's what. But as I point out, you know, even at that early age, America just had a different view than most of the world does. Most of the world would, I think, assume that if a politician was there was an attempt made on his life, the first place you'd look would be at his political opponents. But in America, we didn't do that then, and we certainly don't do it now. We always look for some kind of, and they found a suitably crazed guy, and I describe him in the book, you know, showing up in court and being quite the drama queen in court. But certainly Martin Van Buren, who is Jackson's vice president, always believed that there was a conspiracy to assassinate Jackson. And ever thereafter, he made sure he carried a loaded pistol whenever he went to preside over the Senate.
And the would-be assassin, Richard Lawrence, yes, you describe him in court. I think, wasn't he pretending he was Napoleon Bonaparte?
Yes, something. It was kind of an early-day Charles Manson. So I'm sure if that had happened in the era of television or the Internet, they would have had quite a field day with this guy, Richard Lawrence.
Right. In other words, they were trying to portray this guy as the lone gunman, the lone nut, you know, which has been repeated throughout history, right?
There's not, other than the Lincoln assassination, which was tried as a conspiracy, but even there certainly wasn't, it wasn't really any kind of cohesive political conspiracy. It was just a group of random people led by a demented actor, according to.
Well, we'll definitely get into Abraham Lincoln on the other side. Don Jeffries is my guest here on Coast to Coast AM, the author of Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963, covering nearly 200 years of history. Now, we're not going to get all the way up to JFK on this program, although it's interesting, you write in the introduction that the reason you sort of wrote this book is because you were hearing from readers who were saying, wait a minute, corruption in America didn't start with the Kennedy assassination. Was that kind of the impetus?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I put hidden history because it kind of reflected my personal timeline. I was born, I was a little kid when JFK was assassinated. So that was one of the central events of my childhood and the seminal event of the baby boomer generation. So I wrote it from, and you could make a case that we certainly started really going downhill since the JFK assassination. So I covered all the more modern scandals that I was more familiar with, but I already was a student of history, and I understood, having read about the Lincoln assassination and both world wars and so many other things, I understood that there were lots of crimes and cover-ups there as well. So I did get a lot of people saying, hey, what about this one? I said, well, okay, it seems like a natural book. And initially it was going to be titled Hidden History 2, a prequel. But for whatever reason, the publisher didn't like that part of the title, and they just covered it up. But I'm very pleased to announce that Ron Paul is writing the foreword to this book. So very, very happy to have. I've already seen the initial foreword, so I'm very honored about that.
All right. Don, we'll take a quick time out, come back and talk about Abraham Lincoln. Was he really Honest Abe? And was the Gettysburg Address truly the greatest speech in American history? Tom Waits, Tom Trobert's Blues, taking us into the break on Coast to Coast AM. Scientists from the University of East Anglia have discovered a unique oil-eating bacteria in the deepest part of the Earth's oceans, the Mariana Trench. The Mariana Trench is located in the western Pacific Ocean and reaches a depth of approximately 11,000 meters. By comparison, Mount Everest is 8,848 meters high. To date, only a few expeditions have ever investigated the organisms inhabiting this ecosystem. Dr. Jonathan Todd from UEA's School of Biological Sciences said, "Our research team went down to collect samples of the microbial population at the deepest part of the Mariana Trench. We studied the samples that were brought back and identified a new group of hydrocarbon-degrading bacteria. Hydrocarbons are organic compounds that are made of only hydrogen and carbon atoms. They're found in many places, including crude oil and natural gas. So these types of microorganisms essentially eat compounds similar to those in oil and then use it for fuel. Similar microorganisms play a role in degrading oil spills in natural disasters such as BP's 2010 oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico." Fascinating stuff. You can read this entire article in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. Now, if you like what you're hearing tonight, why not check out my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show, that airs out of Toronto on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, 96.7 FM. And for an affiliate near you, go to my website, strangeplanet.ca, and click on the radio page for The Conspiracy Show. Or you can also stream The Conspiracy Show live on my YouTube channel. Also, check out my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited. New episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen and subscribe at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. The real Abe Lincoln, when my conversation with Don Jeffries continues right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don, in Crimes and Cover-Ups, you refer to Abe Lincoln as he's kind of the last man standing, and that is that all the presidents prior to Abe Lincoln are now sort of discredited and considered, you know, racists. But Lincoln seems to be remaining sort of sacrosanct. You say that he's a secular saint of our corrupt and decaying civilization. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think he's an appropriate secular saint for our particular civilization at this point. Lincoln established so many awful precedents. He was the first imperial president. He was the first president to really go beyond the bounds established by the Constitution as to what his responsibilities of office were. And I have lots of quotes in there, even from court historians who say things like, you know, it's hard to say what Lincoln thought the limit of his powers were. He believed that he could do basically, he used to say, I'm commander-in-chief. And because the country ended up being at war, which I hope I demonstrate in the book, I think was largely his doing, because he's the one that pushed for a war so aggressively, backed by the radical Republicans, who no one else wanted it. The Confederacy certainly didn't want it. But Lincoln established so many awful precedents that when he suspended the writ of habeas corpus, just an unprecedented thing, when thousands, we still don't know how many thousands of Americans were thrown into makeshift prisons simply because they opposed his policies, any of his policies. People were arrested during church services. Later, Clement Vallandigham was one of my largely unsung American heroes, who was Lincoln's greatest critic, foe in the Congress, Democrat. But he was a so-called copperhead. He didn't like Lincoln's policies. He was arrested in the middle of the night. When we saw the raid on Roger Stone's house recently, well, there was a lot of precedent for that. And a sitting congressman was arrested even earlier. They met maybe 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, when soldiers stormed his home and basically took him from there and arrested him because he had criticized Lincoln in speeches. No president had ever done anything remotely like that, but he's praised today because he established the kind of presidency as long now. If, for instance, Donald Trump may be criticized for kind of trying to be a strong president, but he's not really doing anything. The presidents that are considered great by the court historians are, in my opinion, the worst presidents we've had, people like Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, who are the so-called strong presidents who overstepped their boundaries, and they're imperial presidents. They want to push for globalist time. I mean, Lincoln didn't really push for globalism, but Lincoln extended the powers of the presidency so that it ripped to shreds any kind of separation of powers under the Constitution. We were supposed to have three equal branches. Well, under Lincoln, the Congress was just a joke. The judicial branch was largely ineffective as well. Lincoln tried to arrest the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court because he declared Lincoln's suspension of the writ of habeas corpus to be unconstitutional. Lincoln just said arrest him. Luckily, he was counseled not to do that by some cooler heads in his administration, but Lincoln did so many awful things. He was called a tyrant for good reason. Now, I know what I'm saying, and this is going to be one of the most controversial parts of this controversial book. Is going against Lincoln today is sacrosanct, and he is what Professor Thomas DiLorenzo called the Lincoln cult, and they are a cult, and they will come after me if they don't ignore my book. They'll come after me the way they came after Thomas DiLorenzo and Charles Adams, who wrote One in the Course of Human Events. In recent years, scholars like that have shown, and I was largely influenced by them in writing about Lincoln, have shown exactly what Lincoln's true record was, where he was largely responsible for unnecessary bloodshed on a just unbelievable level, or anywhere between 600, now some people think as many as 850,000 Americans died senselessly just simply because he wanted to preserve a union that was never meant to be at the force of arms. I think all Americans until the Civil War thought that our union was voluntary and that the states were free to leave if they so chose. I mean, that was the whole idea of the consent of the governed. But Lincoln did not want the southern states, who no longer consented, clearly, in 1860, to be under this union. He did not want them to leave, and I still believe if he had let the original seven states go and form their own government, they probably would not have been able to stay independent and would have come back to the union rather quickly.
I want to circle back to the Civil War in a moment, Don, but you've given us so much to think about here. And you mentioned President Trump, and he has been vilified in the media who say that they feel threatened during his presidency because, you know, he's called some in the mainstream media the enemy of the people and, of course, bandied about this term fake news. But he has absolutely nothing on Abraham Lincoln. You point out that during the summer of rage, that, you know, should any newspaper criticize him or his administration, I mean, he came down hard. He shut down something like nearly 300 newspapers.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was Lincoln, and that's Lincoln's real record. And it's been brushed over. It's been covered up. It's been excused. As Thomas DeLorenzo was fond of saying, the Lincoln cult finds an excuse for all of Lincoln's behavior, no matter what. When you examine his real record, you realize that one of the main reasons America is so screwed up at this point, in my opinion, and on the verge of collapse, is because this is how our history has been distorted to where, really, I think our most tyrannical president by far, and any, you know, kind of assessment that was honest would probably put him at the absolute bottom in terms of presidents. He is considered by far and away our best president, because the court historians continue to tell Americans he is. Popular opinion tells us that he is, because, again, these are the people that make movies and television shows, and certainly, unlike the Founding Fathers, there have always been plenty. There were biographies of Lincoln as early as the 1930s, or before that even. And so he's never been excluded by Hollywood. He's always be considered a cultural icon, and in recent years he's even been apparently transformed into a great vampire killer.
Yes.
A best-selling book about that.
Yes. You write that during, the Summer of Rage, newspaper offices were broken into by government officials, equipment was destroyed, reporters were literally tarred and feathered, imprisoned without trial, and others were forced to write glowing editorials about Lincoln and his administration.
Yeah, and Lincoln's Secretary of State, John Seward, he would brag to people coming in his office. He'd show them a bell on his desk and said, "I can ring this bell and have any man arrested in the United States." That's the kind of tyranny that Americans were, and this was unprecedented, because up until that point, regardless of what you think about the early Federalists or the early Democrats, that no one had even thought to kind of use to overstep their bounds in such a way, to sit there and say, "I can ring a bell and arrest any American." No one had thought to do that. I mean, John Adams was rightly criticized for the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were awful, but they were nothing compared to what Abraham Lincoln did, and what he established would be later used for precedents by other presidents, because he got away with it. And because later, when he got a more friendly Supreme Court in there, they supported what he was doing. The Congress was run by the radical Republicans. They supported what he was doing. And because he saved and preserved the Union and freed the slaves, that's what his legacy comes down to in our Mick history, our fast food history that served to the masses, he's considered the greatest president. And whatever he did had been used for other awful actions by presidents like Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, down to George Bush during the Gulf War, where his aide John Yoo cited Abraham Lincoln's precedents for the treatment of prisoners, for instance, Guantanamo Bay.
Was he really, the nickname, Honest Abe, you question whether that was maybe deliberately ironic, that name, that he wasn't really honest. You know, there are stories, legends, not unlike, you know, George Washington chopping down a cherry tree and then he couldn't lie about it. There are stories of Abraham Lincoln when he was, I guess, a merchant, you know, running 3 miles to return a couple of pennies to a customer who overpaid. But you wonder whether, in fact, the Honest Abe moniker was deliberately ironic. In other words, he was, it's like calling someone who's a little overweight, calling them skinny, or calling a bald person curly.
Yeah, I think it was a derisive nickname. I think it was something of ridicule, probably invented by his political opponents, because I don't think there's anything on the record that would indicate him. I mean, looking at his record, honestly, he was a pragmatic politician, and unlike my hero Huey Long, who bragged about never taking a case against a poor man, Abraham Lincoln was a corporate-type lawyer. He defended, he didn't ever defend poor people. He defended corporations and banks, and he was a very pro-bank. He certainly believed in a central bank and that kind of thing. He was not any kind of he didn't have a populist bone in his body, and he was, again, our first imperial president, and his actions kind of set the template for the modern presidency. And the Civil War, I think more accurately, war between the states, when it was over, all you need to know about America at that point was, prior to the conflict, the United States was considered a plural term. After the conflict, it was always an individual term, because those states were now one. State power was completely gone, and the original template for the Constitution and for the division of power was completely skewered by what happened from 1861 and to 1865, and largely due to Lincoln's individual actions, because he, whatever machinations are behind the scenes controlling him, even at that early era, he was a hands-on president, much like Franklin Roosevelt would later be. And he clearly pushed policies that he wanted. And I think those policies were a disaster, regardless of what the court historians say. And I think that they forever impacted America in a negative way. And we were certainly never the same country after Lincoln's administration that we were before.
So would you argue that Lincoln was not a committed abolitionist?
Well, I quote from his great racist statements, and again, he issued statements that would make David Duke blush, but he wasn't any more racist than other whites of his time. And again, I think you can probably say 99.9% of whites living in the 1860s would be considered racist by today's standards. And I quote their statements on the record, and Lincoln certainly had lots of them out there. He wanted to colonize blacks back to Africa, which most whites at that time actually wanted to do. They thought that was a solution rather than freeing the blacks. And he didn't even mention slavery in his first State of the Union address. And I put all this out in the book, where he came to realize that it would be just a purely political opportunistic act to free the slaves. And he did that as what he thought would curry international favor. He turned the war into a crusade to free slaves a few years into it. Whereas before that, we are all familiar with this famous quotation about, if I would save the Union by freeing all the slaves, or no slaves, or some of the slaves, I would do it. And in his first inaugural address, he said, I'm not going to interfere with slavery in areas where it's legal, because I don't believe I have the authority to do so. So he changed very quickly, and then later on, and Charles Adams really wrote a lot about this, and went in the course of Human Events, he makes a great argument for Lincoln, who was probably an atheist, too. I go into that, and that may not matter, except for the fact that he invoked God constantly, and he ended up in the last year or two of the conflict basically blaming the war on the will of God, and that this is punishment from the Almighty for slavery. So he changed the theme throughout the course, but he pushed relentlessly for war, and it was really also the war of Northern aggression. The North was always the aggressor. The South simply wanted to be left alone and to form their own government. And we can say, regardless what you think about their beliefs, and certainly none of us support slavery, and I think that's the only reason that people in retrospect can possibly be on the side of this big, strong Goliath, which was the North, against this little plucky David, which was the South, is because of the issue of slavery. Without the issue of slavery, it becomes an obvious David versus Goliath argument, and in those instances, most people are going to side with the underdog. But at any rate, they wanted to govern themselves, and that was supposed to be why we fought a war for independence in the first place. But Abraham Lincoln, who, by the way, also was no friend of the founding fathers. He despised Thomas Jefferson in private, and I'm sure Thomas Jefferson would have despised him as well. He certainly would not. The founding, I don't think any of the founding fathers, except obviously Alexander Hamilton, I'm sure probably would have, but none of the rest, I think they all would have fought for the Confederacy, or at least would have opposed Lincoln's war, like Clement Vallandigham and other Northern critics, and they probably would have all been thrown into makeshift prisons like thousands of other Americans were.
The Gettysburg Address, hailed as the greatest speech in American history. You write, hold on, let's examine that speech. Not so great, right?
Well, as the construction of it is beautiful. I mean, it's very poetic. Certainly, I used to love it as a kid, memorizing and so forth. But as H.L. Mencken, another very far left-wing critic of Lincoln's, wrote, it made absolutely no sense, because here you have Lincoln basically decreeing that the North was dying so that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. And he said nothing could be further from the truth. The North was fighting against that concept, because they were fighting the people of the South who wanted to govern themselves. The North was trying to prevent that. So the whole tone of the speech was absurd on the face of it, because he was defending the people who were trying to suppress consent of the government. So, and that, again, that's considered our greatest political speech, and it just as Abraham Lincoln being our greatest president tells us a lot about the people that govern us now and that control our culture, that the fact that they consider that the greatest speech, again, I'm not talking about schematically or how it sounded, because it was beautifully written, but it completely contradicted the reality of what was going on there, because he was doing anything but defending government of the people, by the people, and for the people.
When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines and take questions and comments for Don Jeffries, the author of The Incendiary, Crimes and Cover-Ups of American Politics, 1776 to 1963. Taking us into the break, here are the Beatles, and I Want to Tell You on Coast to Coast AM.